This episode of the Children's Literature Podcast is brought to you by Barbecues in the British Summer. Barbecues in the British Summer. Get it cooked before it starts raining again. Welcome to the Children's Literature Podcast. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. This episode is an interview with Bally Rye. Each month this year, I'm featuring a children's writer from here in Leicestershire where I live. I've been having way more fun with this project than I could have imagined. Every time I sit down with an author, I'm blown away by how intelligent and thoughtful they are, and how many neat ideas they have, not just about their writing, but the world around them and the people they know. I recently sat down with Bally Rye, a lifelong native of Leicester City, and my Leicestershire children's writer for the month of June, and I instantly became aware that I was sitting down with one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. Bally Rye's books are funny and interesting and engaging and thoughtful, and it's no surprise at all that the author is exactly the same. Our conversation rambles over a whole bunch of topics, and I could hardly trim away any of it because it was all so interesting. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Bally as much as I did. Today I'm joined by Bally Rye, this month's Leicestershire Children's Writer of the Month. Welcome to the show, Bally.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Tell me about your connection to Leicestershire.
I'm born and raised. So I was born and raised in the city of Leicester. I've lived here, apart from 5 or 6 years that I spent in London, nearly 6 years. I've lived here in the city or in the county my entire life. So I'm a product of Leicestershire.
Your historical novel, Now or Never, A Dunkirk Story, is about Faisal Khan, an Indian Muslim soldier who serves in the British Army during World War II. I'd like to know more about the research that went into the book. Was Faisal a real soldier or a composite based on several people?
Faisal is, he's a composite. So Company 32, that's the company that the story follows. There wasn't very much about them. We know, for example, that they were based in Rawalpindi, which is in modern day Pakistan, but British India. We know they were muleteers, so they led mules and horses. We know that they arrived in Europe at Marseille via Mumbai, Cape Town, and then there are little bits of their stories, but in terms of the characters themselves, there was a lot of stuff that I found after Operation Dynamo. So Dunkirk, they ended up in Ashbourne in Derbyshire and then went all over the UK. So some of them were in Wales, the majority were in Scotland, so there's little snippets of them. So I actually took the names from gravestones, because sadly quite a few of them died, mostly from infections, flu, etc. But I think one murdered another one. There was a lot of, essentially after Dunkirk, I think they were expecting to be sent back to India and they weren't. And I don't think a lot of them, from what we know, didn't like the cold and the wet. But yeah, he's a composite of 3 or 4 different characters whose names I saw on gravestones. And then you start to learn about what they actually did. There's very little easy to find data about these people. They're not widely known, so it was a case of digging and finding as much as I could. And then I was helped by Captain John Ashdown, who was their officer, by his son Mark Ashdown. He obviously had Captain Ashdown had a very famous son called Paddy Ashdown, who was a UK politician. But he was very unwell and then passed away while the book was being written. So I think he saw the first draft or seen it. So his family helped me quite a bit to let me know. You do these amazing things with historical fiction where you kind of decide this, posh white guy who's in India is going to need an interpreter. And then the family turn around and go, actually, no, he was fluent in all these languages and could speak to his men. He chose to learn the languages. So a lot of research, a lot of digging, a lot of talking to people who'd done other research. And then particularly the armed forces, so particularly the army. Archives are very, very helpful. So they do keep a record of these things. It's like any bit of historical fiction. Certainly with these missing voices, you've got to dig a bit deeper.
And it's interesting to learn even what you can. You may not be able to completely reassemble the story, but it still makes you think about the complicated relationships and how many layers there are to it. On one hand, you've got this rising independence movement and maybe a lot of people who would say, why should we bother fighting for the British Empire? But on the other, you have these Indian soldiers who served, many with distinction, many just like any other guy, they did their bit.
Yeah.
I'm sure they had the added difficulty of, like you said, coming to a country with completely different weather, completely different customs. There's no Indian food in Britain in the 40s. I mean, there's a lot of great Indian food here now, but back then there's nothing familiar, no piece of home. And the fact that any of them made it through that and were able to do their bit, it's very impressive and worth hearing about.
Obviously, it's very, very interesting. India was in the tail end because it was about to come to fruition over the sort of rebellion against British rule. And it's fascinating to me that, I think a million Indian servicemen and women, servicemen in terms of fighters, no, there were no female troops, but another 1.5 million on top of that volunteered. It's the largest volunteer force in modern history that we know of. So these people basically down tools in terms of, let's get the British out of India, and went, hang on a minute, we should probably help. And did, yeah. But I found that fascinating, and this is one of the reasons I set Fazal up as this young character who is enticed by the camaraderie, the bravery, the supposed glory, and his dreams are shattered very, very, very quickly. And then he has this friend, Mush, who is very cynical and anti-British and is only there because he's getting paid, and he'd earn more money doing that than anything else. So he's thinking about his family, but his only goal is to survive and then get back. That was, for me, one of the most interesting parts. That and the relationship that Ashdown had with his troops. I mean, it's not particularly historically accurate in terms of the conversations, because we don't know what those conversations were. And I've had some interesting feedback, I'll put it that way, from historical kind of, academics, history academics, which is always going to be the case. And the idea with it was I started with the framework, knew what was happening, but then I pulled away because I'm more interested in exploring the human emotions than knowing exactly which street was where and exactly what they wore. I think all that stuff gets a bit boring after a while, because it was supposed to be narrative non-fiction, whatever that is. And it became a fiction because I really don't understand narrative non-fiction. I've written it twice, and both times, to me, you just think, this is just historical fiction, surely. So, but it's a lot of fun.
Well, when you're doing historical fiction, you have to condense. You just have to, especially if it's for children. You cannot write a Tom Clancy-sized book for 10-year-olds. They won't read it.
You'd be surprised. There's a few people that try. But yeah, yeah, you can't. You've just got to... It has to be... For me, the focus is always on the readers. Because you're thinking, well, how old is the potential readership? And we knew it was going to be Upper Key Stage 2. So 9, 10, 11 years old into Key Stage 3. And that's where the book sits. And those are the schools that are, and classes that are using it. And it's really, really popular. So young people, even I think most adults, don't care if you've invented a street or a square or something because you need it for your drama. Yeah, I'm sure I'll get some more interesting feedback from academics, but it wasn't written for academics, it was written for children. And I think I'm very pleased with the way it turned out, because I think it really does show Fazal's... He loses that sense of, this is glory, the glory of war and following, but he's still essentially following in his grandfather's footsteps. Just he wouldn't have known that his grandfather had been through all this stuff. And yeah, no Indian food. In London, there would have been 2 or 3 restaurants in London, in central London, but they weren't in London. They were shipped out to Wales and to the eastern Scotland onto the coast to prepare for a potential invasion of Norway that never happened. So.
You've mentioned that Sue Townsend, a very famous writer from Leicester, was a big influence on you. I definitely saw the influence of Adrian Mole on your character Manny from Unarranged Marriage. He had very believable teenage complaining about his family and his personal problems. Can you tell me about your first experience with Sue's writing and how it helped you develop as a writer?
Yeah, Sue was a massive influence on me. She became my hero, my role model, simply because when I was younger, I was reading Roald Dahl, C.S. Lewis, all this stuff from the age of 6 and 7. And much as I loved those stories, I was never going to meet them. They were never going to come walking into my school, and I couldn't really connect to the characters on anything other than I'm enjoying the story. But if I looked around the room, and this is Leicester in the 1970s, it was incredibly, the city was still incredibly diverse then. So you look around and you see people from all these different backgrounds, and you're not represented, your lives aren't, nor are the real lives of your teachers. And then Sue comes along, writes this book, I read it, and I recognised the streets and I recognised the people. And she was essentially, I said later, when somebody asked me, I wrote an article about it, that she was writing about the next door neighbours. And that's how it felt. And so she was a revelation, because I started thinking, well, if she can write about people from Leicester, I can write about people from Leicester. And I don't have to think, well, I need to write a Roald Dahl style book or a C.S. Lewis style book. So a lot of my early stories after the age of 10, which is when I first read Adrian Mole, were about Leicester. They were about the people that I knew. So she was a massive influence. And then later in life, I got to know her very well, which is kind of weird because, you know, there's that thing about never meet your heroes. That is not true of Sue Townsend. She was amazing. Really helpful, really kind of funny, all the things that I thought she would be. But her writing allowed me to think about Leicester and Leicestershire as a valid starting point to base a story, which, I'll be honest, I never really did before that. Because you just didn't see those stories. I always thought that literature was for other people and it was about other people. And Sue Townsend lived in Leicester. Her kids went to, at least two of them went to my old school and some other schools. They moved around schools. Part of a reggae sound system collective with her younger son now. So, you know, it's a weird thing. It's that you want to be a footballer and the person, somebody lives two or three doors down, becomes a footballer, which is actually the case. Emil Heskey's family were quite well known around there as well. So, you know, or you want to be, I don't know, you want to be play the cello. And you've got a neighbour three doors down and they play the cello and you can learn from them. It's touchable. Sue Townsend was touchable in a way that other authors, for me, simply weren't. She was very, much more real. And I also loved her writing. It was funny. It was honest. It was no holds barred. Even though that sounds weird because it's a comedy about a 13-year-old. She was very sharp about the way she observed British society back in the 1980s and what was going on. And I loved that about her. I loved that. I loved the idea that she was looking at the absurd side of Thatcher's Britain. And she's one of the few authors to do that, I think, successfully.
She's an author that I didn't know anything about until a few months ago. And the more I learn about her, the more I want to read everything she's written. She seems like she must have had a really wicked sense of humor, and I suspect she would have been great at a dinner party.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There are lots of reasons to be sad for me that make me sad about her passing, but one of them is the fact that she didn't get to, Adrian Mole didn't get to observe the kind of post-2015 Tory government years and the, you know, Boris Johnson and, you know, the mess that the Tories have made of their own party and their leadership campaigns and the country. So, and she was very, very critical, uber critical of, for example, Tony Blair. So it wasn't that she was kind of tied to one political side or another. She was very left-wing, very much a supporter of the NHS and the welfare state, which essentially allowed her to bring up her children, looked after her when she was unwell. So, and I think when she passed, people, I wrote an article about how people will forget that she was a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. But she always had a really human way of approaching it. So she'd never, when she wrote The Queen and I, it's actually quite a loving look at the royal family. She humanises them in a way that I don't think media coverage ever does. I think dinner party-wise, I think she'd, who would be your top five dinner party guests? I think she'd be number one or number two on the list, along with Bob Marley, probably.
That would be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I can imagine there'd be a lot of disagreement about various things, but in a lovely way. But yeah, she was an awesome character. I mean, somebody that lost the majority of their sight and continued to have words published. She wasn't writing them, she was dictating them. That's not the point. The idea that she didn't just bury her head under the duvet, she carried on writing, and she was always really, really, really honest. I think her most honest work is The Woman That Went to Bed for a Year, where she talks about depression and basically not wanting to get on with life. So she was always very, very honest, and there's a level of honesty that I think is missing now in a lot of literature that's about Britain. And for me, she was just the best at it. She was a national institution. We realised that when she passed away, and how many people came forward and went, oh my God, Sue Townsend was a massive influence on me, and her writing was a huge influence. So yeah, but there's never going to be another. She was a one-off, and we're lucky to have had her writing, I think. So it's just a shame we're not going to get any more.
Well, I think writers like you will keep her alive.
We'll try, yeah. It's like I said, it's a real shame that she's no longer with us.
One of the traits of Sue Townsend's writing, as I understand it, is that she's very rooted in realism. Real places, real towns, real streets, even a real timeline. The Adrian Mole books follow our real timeline.
Yeah.
I also see that realism in your Soccer Squad books. They really paint a three-dimensional picture of how little boys interact. They have these deep emotions, but they kind of keep them internal sometimes because they feel the need to posture or they worry about what others will think. Yet by playing this sport together, they forge these very strong emotional bonds, and it reminded me of the movie The Sandlot. It's set in Los Angeles in the 1960s, and it's about little boys who play baseball together. It has a very similar vibe where, like, they're not going to discuss their deep emotions with one another, and they can be incredibly thoughtless and immature at times. But by coming together over this sport that they love, they're able to forge these lasting friendships and discover things about themselves and become marginally better people because, look, they're kids. They're only going to make so much progress in the space of one story. And I really like books that show that. So I was curious about which experiences you had that helped you paint such a sweet and realistic picture of these little boys in the Soccer Squad books playing football together.
I think a lot of it is, it's very easy for me to think back to when I was younger. And I played a lot of football, and I played, obviously, mostly with boys. And so a lot of those characters, in fact, every single one of the characters in Soccer Squad is based on somebody I either knew then or somebody I know now that I used to play football with that I reimagined as a 10-year-old, which is kind of easy to do. I have this thing about men. It's a joke I make in schools, and I say, you know, most men, two beers, and they're back to being 10 years old anyway, to all intents and purposes. So it was easy for me to do because that's what me and my friends were doing. And you noticed that there were some of us that were more willing to talk about how we felt, and then most of us, those feelings came out in other ways. But also, I wanted to write just a regular story about, because it's a story about boys, it's a series about boys and girls playing football together, which was key for me because my oldest daughter played lots and lots of football and was occasionally, you know, the boys were occasionally mean to her, and she was better than most of the boys that she was playing with. So it was set around that, but I wanted to create a kind of positive story about young heterosexual men. Not that there's anything wrong with being gay or whatever, but it's just we have this thing where there were lots of stories about young heterosexual men potentially being a problem in this area or that area, or whatever, you know, learning sort of misogyny, etc. And I wanted to be really honest about how little boys really are, which is most of them are just really lovely and really mardy sometimes and really can be quite, you know, annoying, but also do lovable things. And it was easy for me to do that because that's what I was and that's what my friends were. So it was kind of thinking back to the whole, you know, I'm a big Liverpool fan, so the Liverpool-Manchester United debate, you know, the oh God, I'm not playing with girls, even though he's that kid that says that in Sox Wars, never really thought that through. It's literally just a reaction. But that's exactly what you get from a boy that age. I watch my little girl, and she goes and kicks a ball with some of her male friends. Like, oh, it's a girl. The girls kick the ball. They're not being sexist or misogynist. It's just a very, very weird reaction that they have. And you can see that often they're thinking a lot more than we give them credit for, and they're feeling a lot more. So, yeah. There was a thing in publishing as well for a long time. When I started, when my first one came out, the publishing was really hot on writing stories for boys because boys weren't reading enough. And then all of a sudden the kind of explosion in YA was essentially female protagonists, and boys aren't reading that, or very few of them. So it kind of every 10 years they go, oh, boys, we forgot about boys. So it was part of that as well. I remember talking to the editor and they wanted a boys only football story, and I was like, I won't do a boys only one because it's been done any number of times, and I want to write it for my daughter and her friends, her female friends who play football as well. I want them to feel part of it. So, no. I've always been good at observing human beings. I listen to them and I watch them. And so a lot of that goes into my writing. But specifically for Soccer Squad, every single one of them, male and the female players, the coaches, you know, the teachers at school, the school itself, all based in reality. So they're all real.
I think you're right. The market can sometimes forget boys. It just does. It's hard because, of course, you want to have things for girls and meet the needs of niche markets and small groups of people, but boys are half the population of children, and there will never not be little boys.
Yeah.
The more stories they have that give them healthy, reassuring models of how to grow up and how to make friends and how to work through problems, the better. They need to hear, you know, you're not going to be perfect. You're going to make mistakes.
Yeah.
It's so important, and boys need it.
They do, yeah. And just the idea that you can that those books hopefully show them that you can be a little bit of a Mardy bum and you can make mistakes and you can get things wrong, but it doesn't make you a bad person. You're not alone in those reactions. So, yeah, it's vitally important. I mean, right now with publishing, I mean, there's a big move now. People are saying we don't have teen books. We don't have teen books in the UK. We have middle grade. We have young adult. Now, we don't have grades. So middle grade itself is an issue with schools because they don't know where to place them. So there's a big move now to go back to, which is what how I started writing, which is teen fiction, which is specifically aimed at teens. And YA has kind of, for me, kind of ruined that because it's disappeared. And I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of YA, the market the way it is at the moment, and I haven't been for a while. I mean, I haven't written a YA novel in anger for 7 years. The last one I did was Web of Darkness. I've just done something for a company called Barrington Stoke, which is shorter, but that's my first YA in 7 years. And even that, in my head, that's teenage, not YA. So I think the focus on boys is important. I do a lot of work with schools, and boys not reading is the single biggest factor that holds them back, but also in terms of social and emotional development, and giving them the lateral thinking kind of abilities and the processing to allow them to see themselves in the world and see what the impact their actions have on others. We know that people who don't read aren't particularly empathetic. And so to promote greater empathy and understanding for young, predominantly heterosexual boys, we need to get them reading, and we need to write or publish stuff that they can access and that they're going to enjoy. Yeah, I think it's vitally important.
You've written books like Unarranged Marriage, which deals with the forced marriage of children, and Killing Honor, which talks about honor killings of young women who step out of line. These are topics that are usually tackled by female writers and critics. It was really encouraging for me to see a male author address these issues from the point of view of young male protagonists, speaking of stories for boys. I don't believe these problems can go away unless men and women work together. How do you think problems like child marriage, forced marriage, and honor killing should be dealt with?
It's a difficult one, but for me, the starting point was to talk to, or to have a male protagonist talking about it, because it just hadn't been done. Now, I hadn't, with Unarranged Marriage, I didn't think, oh, it's the first ever male British protagonist, you know, talking about it. And it's the reason that the book is still around now, because it wasn't done before that, and it hasn't been done since. But I don't want to sound like I was really clever and I'd looked at the market and gone, I just decided that, and I've always thought this, within my own family, if you don't educate young men and talk to them about why a certain kind of action is misogynistic or sexist and patriarchal and will hold the women in their families back, if you don't talk about that and explain that, they're never going to change. So it was definitely an attempt at getting a conversation started. And I said this from the very start when I'd go into schools or talk to people. I wanted young men to start a conversation with each other about what Manny's going through and how he feels about those situations. And then with the other books, it's the same thing. And I totally agree. We can't change it unless we talk to men about it. And we talk to each men and women talk to each other about it. And we have to start with young men. We have to start talking to them about how they take on certain, what they will call traditional values and expectations that aren't really traditional. Or if they are, it's a patriarchal tradition and it's a sexist and misogynistic tradition that often bears no relation to what their religions teach them, and the difference between the religions and the cultures that are mostly patriarchal that are built up around religion. So Sikhism, particularly for me, because that's what my family follow. The Sikh holy book is the only one that explicitly states that men and women are born equal, and it states that right at the beginning. And yet Sikh society, which is essentially Punjabi society, is entirely patriarchal and horrifically sexist in places, to the point where men and women are made to sit separately in a Sikh temple. We need to have these conversations, and we need to have them with young men, and they're uncomfortable conversations, but that was the whole point of those books, is to get that conversation started and to get beyond the discomfort of, oh, we don't talk about this, we need to talk about it. So not talking about it is no longer an option, and it never should have been in the first place.
When you're talking about problems like this, as you said, it's incredibly important, but it can also be difficult because you are coming from a minority culture. The culture's already dealing with perhaps not being 100% accepted or understood. There can be people who mean well, but they just misunderstand the culture or don't have very much exposure because it's a minority group. There's not a lot of people to mingle with the entire population. Because of this, did you ever get pushback from members of your culture saying, look, why are you talking about these problems? Can't you talk about our food, our holidays, the fun stuff? Everyone likes these things and it helps show our good side. Did you ever have to deal with the tension that can come with airing problems in a more public way?
Yeah, that's I've had that since the first book was published. It was April 2001 that book came out, so Unarranged Marriage, and I've had it ever since. I've been accused of, you know, highlighting the negatives and, you know, ignoring the positives. I've been accused of hating my own culture. I know my original agent tried to sell the book to Indian publishers and they were like, oh no, this person hates their own culture. So yeah, I've had a lot of that. I've had members of my family who haven't even read the books but have heard about the themes question why I write those themes. And that for me is a good thing. If I wasn't facing that kind of feedback from certain sections of British Asian society, I'm not doing my job properly. I mean, the idea is the books tackle and they poke at the sexists and the misogynists. They poke at the predominantly men, but also women that try to force their kids into futures that they don't want. It's about the prejudice and racism within those communities as well that I have seen in my own family, within my own community. And I'm poking at that. And if those people are happy with what I'm writing, I'm not doing my job properly. And it is about, again, uncomfortable conversations. But if we need to have these conversations, we need to speak to young women particularly, but also young men, about the fact that there is a law against forced marriage in this country, and they have rights and they need to understand what those rights are, and that you don't have to follow what a member of your family tells you you have to do, because that's not the way things really work. Those types of situations, conversations, make these people who have a negative view of what I do, make them very uncomfortable and make them very angry. But that's, I always knew that was going to happen, and it's, if anything, it sounds odd, but I welcome it, because as I said, it means I'm on the right track. If it's getting them to think about, even if it's making them angry, maybe that anger then dissipates into something where they actually sit and think about the reasons why they believe what they believe and do what they do. But they are, a lot of Sikhs in the UK, Punjabis, will, they don't really understand the religion that they profess to follow. They don't understand that it's about equality. They don't understand that it's about removing class systems, caste systems, all the rest of it. They stick to these rigidly. And I think a lot of young people, certainly now, have become more open about challenging that. And I still get a lot of emails now from, actually social media messages now, but from people who are adults who read it when they were younger, and it helped them to think about their own situation, which is always really, really wonderful to hear. But, you know, it started off, the first one was always about starting a conversation. And essentially not starting a conversation, but kicking, there was a door that was closed, and it was about kicking that door in and going, right, we're not going to have this anymore, we're going to talk about it. It still happens today. I still get negative feedback today from various members of various communities, but it won't stop me doing what I'm doing. I think if it's upsetting people, you look at who it's upsetting. If it's upsetting people who are illiberal and who are misinterpreting religion in order to progress their own kind of sexist patriarchal views, and then fine, great.
I would say that the sort of criticisms you've put forward are not an indication that you don't care, but an indication of how much you care about your culture and the people within it. Because you wouldn't have bothered writing anything if you didn't care.
Yeah.
And it shows that you want things to improve for everyone.
I just don't want it to be saris and samosas. The whole thing about, you know, the happy, nice stuff, the food, the culture, yeah, it's great. I call it saris and samosas. Now, that's been done. You can, it's certainly with films, and there are some great films. I mean, my favourite by Gurinder Chadha is Bargee on the Beach, for example, which is actually, I think, one of the best ones. And then East is East, which has had loads and loads of criticism recently, because we're now looking at it through a modern day lens rather than the lens of when it was written and what it's about in terms of domestic abuse, etc., that film portrays, and the language that it uses, which is the most honest language I've ever heard an Asian family in any kind of fictional representation use. It's fantastic. So that saris and samosa side of it is all well and good, but that's not the reality. And I'm very much influenced by Sue Townsend, mostly, and also Essie Hinton, who, you know, wrote The Outsiders when she was 17. I've still not got over that. I remember reading that as a 12-year-old when I probably shouldn't have, and going, she was 17 when she wrote this. But that honest, in-your-face reality is, for me, the starting point of everything I do. And so if that means that it's not saris and samosas and dancing around, you know, Bangra, you know, dancing to Bangra music, then great, that's not what life is like. That's all wonderful, but it's used, for me, in my opinion, to hide or to sweep under the carpet a lot of very, very important issues that we have yet to tackle effectively within British Asian society in the UK, whether those people be Muslims, Hindus, Jains, Sikhs, it doesn't really matter. There's a lot of stuff that's just swept under the carpet, under the guise of saris and samosas and, you know, what nowadays is called celebrating diversity, which is another thing I don't actually get. When I was growing up, me and my mates, where we were part of multicultural inner city communities, and our starting point was we were the same, you know, basically human beings with things that we did that were slightly different, but actually the starting point was we were the same. It seems to me now a lot of the diversity stuff that I see is just telling people you're different, and I don't think that's positive. I don't think telling different communities that they should celebrate how different they are to each other is conducive to positive and happy community relations. And I think some of the stuff we've seen recently in Leicester, Birmingham, places like that, is proving me and people like me right. I've been saying it for years. I think it's bizarre that we do that. But it's these are more conversations. These are thoughts that I can kind of progress. It just gives me more to write, and it gives me more to get my teeth into. As I said, haven't done that for a while in terms of modern Britain, but I will be doing more of it.
That's good to hear. Let's wrap up with something a bit lighter. Tell me about your passion for reggae music.
Oh, when I was growing up in, I grew up in Highfields, North Evington, sort of inner city Leicester. Reggae was the street music of the time. So it was ska, then rocksteady, then reggae. So in the 70s, when I was 4, 5, 6 years old, you couldn't walk around the streets of Leicester without hearing reggae coming out of car stereos. People would have their windows open. They'd move the speakers to the window sill and sit outside and listen. So reggae was everywhere, and I was massively influenced by it. So there's a song called OK Fred, and the version that I'm thinking of was by a singer called Errol Dunkley, and that was on the radio. We used to sing it on the way to school. It's a very catchy, kiddie kind of jolly little tune. And then obviously Bob Marley, who was massive. He was such a big influence on so many of us. So the young black males around us were massively influenced by reggae music. That influence found its way into the rest of us, whether we were white, Asian, Chinese descent, it didn't really matter. And that was it. Once you, and I think with reggae, I don't think, I know, once you fall in love with it, on the level that I did, it becomes an addiction. You don't fall out of love with reggae. It's always been the soundtrack to my life. And I collect reggae vinyl. Like I said, I'm part of a reggae sound system collective called King Flame now. So we're always, as reggae fans, there's always more reggae to discover. It's the soundtrack to the days that I remember most clearly when I was younger, but also gave me a kind of a social justice leaning that has never left either. Because, you know, I used to see comparisons between what Rastafarians were preaching, for example, and Sikhs, in terms of, if you take away some of the misogynistic stuff the Rastafarians do, a lot of it was about equality and peace. It was just, you know, like with every other religion, there were different levels of it. But, and bass lines. This is a thing. Catchy, easy to dance to, bass lines. Summer, it reminds me of sunshine. But yeah, massive influence on me.
Do you want to tell me about what you're working on at present, or where people can find you online?
Online, despite the fact that I don't always reply on a regular basis, because I avoid it like the plague sometimes, but Twitter, Facebook. I'm at Bally Rye on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. There's an official Bally Rye page. I also have a website, ballyrye.co.uk. And my latest book is a BBC Penguin adaptation, a Doctor Who adaptation of Treasure Island. So it's called Rebellion on Treasure Island. And sadly, it was due to be out in 2 months' time. They've now pushed it back again to September. So my next one will be out in September. And I've got a couple of bits coming out with Barrington Stoke, hopefully very, very soon. So one, certainly, which is a kind of gritty teenage story about a young man who is attacked and murdered for wearing a turban, loosely based on a real case from quite a few years ago. So yeah, always working on something. There's always something in the pipeline.
Ballyrai, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Children's Literature Podcast. Please subscribe and give the show a rating. Send comments to letters@childrensliteraturepodcast.com. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. Thanks for listening.